Many executives thought that was absolutely impossible. But when you're forced to switch and you can compare before and after, you realize many things that you believed to be true, in fact, are false.
My name is Yaniv Korem. I'm here to study successful innovation professionals and uncover the mindset and models they use to de-risk the future. On this podcast, I invite fellow professors, practitioners, and entrepreneurs to have an honest conversation about the business of innovation. No more bullshit. We talk openly and honestly about what works and what doesn't. So come on, get your ass in that seat. School's about to start. Hey, John. Welcome to the School of Innovation.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
You have worked with the legendary Dr. Bose.
Exactly. So I was a teaching assistant for him for acoustics 6.312, as well as I did my master's thesis under his supervision.
Okay. What was the project? Like, how did you get into that situation of even, you know, working for him or with him?
Well, this is a really interesting story. So I was accepted at MIT, Stanford, and Berkeley, but thought my chances of getting financial support was better at MIT. So I drove across, I accepted, but they had no promise of funding. And I drove across the country without any way to pay tuition, being willing to take the risk and knowing I had some confidence in my ability to find some kind of work. Well, it turns out that they have a very efficient way of matching students with either teaching assistant positions or research associate positions, RAs or TAs, I'm sure you know about. And I was offered an RA, which is more desirable than a TA teaching assistant, because there's less grinding and more peer research. Even though I had that invitation in hand just a few days after I moved into MIT, I went to my first class of Dr. Bose's course in acoustics, and he said, we've had something unfortunate happen, and our teaching assistant has dropped out and can't be with us for the course. Is there anyone there who would be interested in being TA? And so I sheepishly raised my hand. And he said, okay, we'll talk to you. I had a 20-minute interview with him, 20 minutes. And even though I hadn't taken acoustics before as an undergraduate, he said that was okay. And he just grilled me on something called Laplace transforms. It's a very easy way to turn differential equations into much simpler polynomial expressions, which is much easier to solve, as many of you may know. Anyway, that's all he drilled on. And fortunately, my undergraduate education was in systems engineering, and that was just absolutely right up my wheelhouse. And so I survived that interview. And I learned from him. He basically judges character in the first 5 or 10 minutes of being with someone. And it's very, very hard to change his initial impression. Exactly. Yeah. It's easy to lower it. It's hard to raise it.
So let me get this straight. You basically downgraded your position from an RA to a TA to work with Bose?
And people thought I was crazy, but actually, I was in heaven. Yeah, you know. But it was basically an offer to really learn the subject, acoustics, well, which I had a tremendous passion for. You know, there's this evolution of competency. The first is learning and then doing, and then finally is teaching, is the highest level of understanding. And so I knew if I had to teach it, I'd have to understand it. And I can tell you, I learned humility in that. There are some awfully smart students in there. And one student, in fact, turned in a problem that took me 5 pages to solve. He solved it in less than 1 page. I couldn't even understand it. And so I took it to my roommate, who was a math major, and he said, no, this is correct. So rather than downgrade him, I had to really tell him that this is one of the simplest and elegant solutions I've seen. He was a freshman, by the way, and he's taking an upper division class.
Wow. So,
pretty skilled people there. It was great. Yes. As you know, it was a great environment.
No, yeah. I mean, I think we were all struck by sort of this imposter syndrome thing, you know, as when we get into MIT, it's like, yeah, someone made a mistake. You know, I shouldn't be here. All these people are so much smarter than I am that, yeah, it takes a while to kind of overcome that.
Yeah, I had that, absolutely had that in spades. And if you look at a distribution curve, I knew I was in the top decile or bottom decile of those that got in. But nevertheless, they treat their grad students very well. And it's far different from being an undergraduate, as you know. It's a tough environment for undergrad, but for grad students, it's like heaven.
It's like heaven, exactly. Yes, I remember that. And so, okay, so you start working for or with Dr. Bose, and what were you working on? Like, what was the dynamics of working with him? Like, I'm curious about that because it's, you know, in the space of innovation, it's kind of, it is unique working with like a master, like, you know, it's kind of those sort of these apprenticeships that we used to see back in the day. And I'm kind of curious about the dynamics of that. What was that like?
Well, it was phenomenal. As I said, he really invests in people, and that's really true, meaning that if he thinks you have potential, he will spend enormous amounts of time with you, kind of sharing in his thinking process and participating on his journey. So it was one in which he was very egalitarian and shared the invention rights equally with the people that worked with him. And it was very interactive. I would easily spend 3 or 4 hours with him at a stretch in his office, going through equations and discussing various solutions, which were usually pretty difficult. And so he was, talk about a master and apprentice, he was a phenomenal, phenomenal teacher, phenomenal master. And one of the best examples of that is when he would ask a question, and you could see this happen in real time, he would actually parse the question, knowing the student and their background, figure out what the real question the student was asking. Then he would answer it in a way in which the student could understand, knowing their background. And so he took such care in listening, which is a lot of innovators don't listen at all. They don't want any input from anyone about anything. But Dr. Bose was not like that. He listened carefully to the questions that students asked and then answered them in a way that they could understand. And the same way with me. We would have these dialogues, and I felt, although I was hardly an equal, it was one in which he encouraged participation. And one of the things that I learned that was really fascinating and it served me so well in life is the notion of focus, which is you can't be good at everything. I mean, very, very few people are. I mean, maybe Richard Feynman or something has some enormous breadth of skills. But one of the things Dr. Bose did is focused. He only taught one class, which was acoustics, which was one term of the year. And then when he was at work, away from his class, he would not at all care about or listen to finance or operations. Didn't care at all about that. The only two areas he really, really loved were engineering and marketing. That was it. And he was incredibly focused on those two areas, and he hired very capable people to work for him that would take on those duties that he found less enjoyable, such as operations or determining the financial condition of the company. So his ability to focus was just uncanny.
Well, it sounds like the mark of a true master, right? He knows what he's good at and he knows what he sucks at. and he focuses on, he doubles down, he triples down on the things that he's good at and he enjoys, you know, doing.
Absolutely. And he would work 60, 80 hours a week. I mean, he would work all the time, and he worked very, very hard. And it was, and typically he'd only work on one problem at a time. Not only was he focused in that he didn't pay attention to those other areas. Yes, but when he was innovating, all he did would be to focus on the current thing he was working on. And we, very early on when I started the company and was involved in developing the active noise cancellation headset, we also were solving another problem at the same time. It had to do with measuring the output of a loudspeaker in different parts of the room. And I was making so much more progress in the noise canceling headphones than I was in the speaker measurement project. We dropped the speaker measurement program, and we focused exclusively on the headphones. And we never looked back. We didn't second guess that. And so I think there's ability of luck. He says many, many great ideas fall within inches of the trash can. So there's a bit of luck as well.
That's a good thing to remember. And I think, you know, I think in terms of industry and the space of innovation today, you know, companies are plagued with lack of focus. I mean, they're trying to do so many things at once that they're all over the place.
That is so true. I'm on the board of Cirrus Logic, which is a semiconductor company, also in the audio space as well. And one thing I really pride the management in is their ability to really concentrate on what's important and focus and not try and be all things to all people. And, you know, in different companies, focus means different things. It could be a focus on your product solution. It could be a focus on how you work with, develop, and treat customers. It could be culture and how you treat employees, or it could be shareholders or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that you're absolutely right. And oftentimes when I consult in the area of innovation, what I find is the problem you mentioned about focus is absolutely a challenge to most companies. This is especially true in product development, where they try and take on way too many projects.
Way too many things.
Exactly.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you've got a limited, you know, you've got a limited bandwidth. The minute you start spreading it around, you spread yourself thin, you're going to run out of resources. And then, you know, you won't be able to kind of see whatever you want to see through, right? It's like, you're going to be like you said, inches from making that big breakthrough because you spread yourself too thin and you don't have enough resources to keep going.
That's absolutely right. In fact, what you say is so true. If you look at many people are overloaded, there's something that I'm sure you believe in or know about, you may call it differently, but I call it the context switching time, which is basically when you go from one task to another, you can't do it instantaneously. It takes you a few minutes to get back into the deep thought that you would once abandon. And so this focus has many, many different ramifications, and focus of attention span is absolutely critical.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about process, because I'm going to hint to something you did at Apple later on, and I'm hoping we'll get a chance to get to that. But let's talk about the innovation process working with and at Bose and with Dr. Bose. What was that like? And maybe I'll focus that question a little bit more in terms of, you know, connecting to users or understanding user needs and wants, dealing with uncertainty, all these things that are part of the innovation process. What was that like working with Bose?
So very interesting and strong similarities with Apple. And that is that on the really revolutionary things that Dr. Bose would come up with, they would absolutely be, you know, new to the world. And it's really hard to talk to someone to give you feedback on an idea that doesn't really exist yet, only in your mind. So both Bose and Apple, I would say, bifurcated. They had a great leader who was a great inventor who could see over the treetops and come up with a game-changing innovation. So they had that mode of innovation. And then it was followed with actually the executors, the product owners, product managers, and lead tech leads and so forth, would then get the details right with the customers. So you innovate based on deep intuition, and Steve Jobs and Amar Bose did this so well in so many different cases, independent of customer feedback. But then once when the idea is firming up, they do engage with the people who are more implementers to make sure that they don't make any mistakes that would be...
So validation.
Exactly, validation. Exactly, okay. Right. And I had this problem with the headphones. It was an opportunity, actually, because when we worked on this innovation, we thought its biggest benefit to consumers was improving the tonal balance, so sound music would sound better. Turns out that that's not what people cared about. They cared about noise reduction. And even as an inventor, we did not adequately anticipate what would be the true unique selling proposition. That was determined by consumers, not by Dr. Bose or myself.
Do you remember how you came about realizing that?
Absolutely. And it's here where I think something people, innovators often make this mistake, is they don't have the technologists interact with customers. They have it done through the marketing person or sales or whatever, and it's buffered. But in my case, Bose was very keen on getting government financing. And so I went around to various services in the government and signed up Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it was to improve communication in jet fighters. In other words, relying on the noise reduction. And that really, as you said, reoriented our focus for research, which was to improve that area more than the musical fidelity.
Yeah. I was just, right before we started the interview, I was reading or watching some video who said that marketing was too important to leave it to the marketing department. So it's interesting that you mentioned marketing several times, and I absolutely agree with that. It's all integrated. It's all, and it's even becoming more integrated today. Like, it's very hard to, you know, separate between the disciplines. The technologists do need to speak with the users, essentially.
Right. And I can give you a really great example in my work with Dr. Bose with regard to the acoustic wave radio, which is another project that I worked on. And that was that he would, in fact, if he came upon a real difficult problem, he would actually innovate in distribution channels. And so he realized that if we did this wave radio, which would cost more, maybe $200 or $300 versus $20 for a clock radio, there's no way consumers would hear it if it was through a typical big box retail store. So he brainstormed, and he first tried, believe it or not, door-to-door sales. And then he tried network marketing, and then he tried mail order. And finally figured out that going direct to consumers was the best way. So he was one of the rare innovators, to support your point about marketing's too important to be left with the marketers, who would also innovate in channels of distribution.
Right, right. And also not getting bogged down in like these, you know, these rules, these bullshit rules of like how you do something, but really kind of, you know, think with sort of a childlike mind and kind of experiment with different ideas.
Yeah, and fundamentally what it really is the ability to listen and come to a situation when you interact with people being free from solution, but rather really find out what problem they're trying to solve.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So since I mentioned Apple, you created a product process at Apple. Can you share with the listeners what that is and what that means?
Sure, and again, it is a story with twists and turns. When I was originally invited to work with them, I flew to California and had some meetings with executives, and just in a way, kind of like being able to really listen and adapt, I was asked to put in place metrics or KPIs for product development. And I looked at them and I said, you don't need metrics. You don't have a consistent way of doing things. You can't scale. Every new product launch is different, and they were dramatically growing. And so they were having different divisions trip over each other. And so they were open-minded, and they realized, yes, you're probably right. Before we measure something, we should probably know what we're doing in a consistent, repeatable manner. So we flipped immediately to work on their innovation and development processes, basically in putting super lightweight structure around them. It had something like 3 check-ins and 2 defined deliverables. And we started and we used an approach with Apple, which they and I use to this day, which is called inch wide, mile deep. And that is, when you're making a change to your innovation system, it's best not to try and change everything at once, but rather focus on the most important thing in your innovation and development process and really get that right. There were 60 teams we were working with at Apple. And if we didn't focus, this comes back to focus, and just, let's say, adopt a new process or a new method or a new way of working and really get that right, we would try and implement 10 or 20 examples of that, and none of them would be right. So we selected one inch wide, mile deep, and we, in fact, managed change by measuring behavior. We had very simple metrics, did come back to metrics, but it was basically, are they walking the talk? Are they doing what we talked about and agreed to do? And we found in some cases they weren't, and it wasn't intentional. It turns out we trained the wrong people. And so we went back and worked with, in this case, project coordinators to basically describe the new ways of working. And once we did that, we were off to the races.
Wow. So measuring behavior within the company?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
So when you're undergoing any kind of transformation, whether it's to put an innovation system or a digital transformation or what have you, it's really important that people start executing new behaviors and use the new nomenclature and start actually adopting what's being trained. And we would actually look at and see how people were behaving. And we measured their behaviors in a very simple way. And we plotted them against a target curve, because we know, based on organizational technical complexity, change can either be very simple and overnight, or change can take months if you're trying to, you know, work with a supplier, and trying to change how you do things with the supplier takes longer than a day or a week. So by having good targets and a focus on simple behaviors, we were able to see, are we making a difference? And this was an early warning indicator, what I call a predictive metric of new ways of doing things, was to measure incremental behaviors to know that you were on the right track.
What sort of lessons have kind of carried on with you through the years and you find yourself applying on a day-to-day basis?
You know, we're going to come full circle here and say that it's actually focus. When I fly and meet with companies that I work with, there are people in the front of the plane and those in the middle and the back of the plane. And a lot of the people in the front of the plane are there because they do something very, very well. And they, in fact, focus. So probably the whole plane is half MBAs, the flights that I take, but it's you just can't be good at everything. And so to be really good, you really need to find an area in which you absolutely can be the best that you possibly can be and be best at that. And I think the notion of focus is really important, but also listening to the customer, not coming up with a solution and asking them how they like it, but rather open-ended listening, truly inquire about what their needs are, really can help ensure that your focus is directed in the right way. So I think it's both a yin and a yang of work, which is kind of combines and holds in one hand at one time notions of agility and flexibility and rigidity and focus. And it's customer insight that really can help you freeze and unfreeze. Those are the things that really have been valuable for me.
All right. I'm going to try and make perhaps it's going to be a stupid metaphor, but you know, I'll give it a try. I'm thinking about the noise canceling headphones, right? It's that ability to switch them on and off, right? As you switch them on and you're focused and you're on your way, you're making progress toward what you think is the right direction, but then you can switch them off and get sort of the ambient, you know, it's not noise, it's people talking, what they care about, you're observing them, you get feedback from them, and that sort of influence or shapes, again, the direction that you're going on once you turn the noise canceling back on. What do you think about that metaphor?
It's a very useful metaphor. I never thought of it in that way before, but the fact of the matter is it is the facility that one has to be able to switch something off and switch something on quickly that allows you to be flexible and innovative. So just like that, the headphone experience of a simple switch dramatically changing your point of view, allowing you to get feedback, I think is a great metaphor for the innovation process.
I like that you added speed to it. You're absolutely right. I think the ability to do it quickly is key here, because a lot of companies, some that I've worked with, there's always risk involved. And when there's risk, there's pain involved. So switching, you know, turning on the switch or switching the thing on and off entails some sort of pain. And a lot of them are not willing to, you know, bear that pain, if that's the right word. So doing that quickly, it's kind of like the Band-Aid, right? You have to do it quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the perceived pain in making the change is a blocker. But the fact is, and this has been so proven right now in a great way, although we have a terrible problem with the COVID virus at this point in time, what it has found is there are going to be some changes that are going to be permanent. And that has to do, for example, with remote work. Many executives thought that was absolutely impossible. But when you're forced to switch, and you can compare before and after, you realize many things that you believed to be true, in fact, are false. And this whole period is really, it's a really abundance of richness if we think about, well, what have we learned as a result of this process, this terrible pandemic that we're having? There are some silver linings.
Yes, I agree. And on that optimistic note, John, if our listeners want to learn more about you and what you do, or maybe even get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, sure. Probably to visit my website, tcgen.com, or send me a note at jcarter@tcgen.com. I'd love to hear from you.
Okay, perfect. I'll put those in the show notes. John, thank you so much for being on the show.
This was great and a lot of fun too. Thank you for inviting me.